Blog Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to the Born to Talk radio show. I'm your host, Marcia Witeka, and I've just got to say, I'm shouting out to myself here. I've just said,
Marcia.
Hi, Chris. Are you there?
I'm here. Where'd you go?
Oh, my gosh. The beauty or the ugliness of live radio. Holy cow. How does my call drop? I have no idea.
I have no idea.
So,
I thought it was me. I was worried it was me or my
Wi-Fi
or something. Anyway, what do we do now?
Oh, well, what we're going to do is we're just going to say, guess what? Welcome to my world, Chris. You know, when you are a writer and you have a deadline ahead of you, there isn't anybody that's hanging up on you. But clearly,
right.
This was supposed to be my challenge today, and you know what? High five, I've just met it. So I don't know what was recorded up till now. Thank goodness that you have a humor. That helps.
Well, the early days of the Wright brothers when they'd lose a plane we're starting that, you know, we're in that sort of early pioneer days of all this kind of stuff. So even now,
dang.
So anyway,
dang.
Yeah.
I think I was just bragging about how I've been doing this for 3 years. Good God. Welcome to my world. Geez. Well, anyway, what I wanted people to know, and you know what? Nobody's going to cut us off, so we're just going to keep talking here. I wanted people to know just how I came about meeting you. And that's a shout-out to my really good friend. I've known Leah McKinney since the seventh grade, Leah McKinney Buckley.
Right.
And she
right.
invited me to join you on your happy hour hiking club. And, by the way, that was quite fun. We went from the Venice Pier to the jetty, and then we went to a vegan restaurant for a dinner and drinks, which I thought was very interesting.
Right.
And that was
I thought it was a great place. Yep.
It was fabulous. So now that we're back on target here, would you like to just take a few moments for those people that are listening, that stayed around,
Right.
Tell our audience a little bit about yourself, because not everybody knows you the way we do. So where did you grow up and go to school, all that good stuff?
Well, I'll give you a little bio. It's not the most exciting
sure.
thing in the world. It's a pretty conventional life. I grew up in Chicago. I was going to go to law school and ended up in journalism. I loved Jim Murray. There's a name that people will recognize, the great sports writer for the LA Times.
Mm-hmm.
He basically changed my life. There's two writers who changed my life. One was Mike Royko, columnist with the Chicago Sun-Times at the time. And then Jim Murray, who just – there was just something about their writing that just felt like it was a letter. You know, it was like a personal letter. And it was fantastic. And I was sort of smitten. I became very, you know, I was just very, very impressed with that. And it just spoke to me. I remember being 14 years old and going out and buying the Sun-Times in Chicago to read Mike Royko. Because I just was a newspaper geek. And I don't think I was particularly geeky generally, but maybe I was. But that's how much I liked Royko. My dad loved Royko. And then I found Jim Murray. Once I got to college, I found Jim Murray. Anyway, so they sort of swung me out of this career path of going to law school and maybe going into TV or journalism with a law degree, which is something that my father also suggested. And all of a sudden I was in print journalism just at the time when it was about to die. about 1978, 1980, and all the afternoon papers were starting to fade and nobody knew what was happening. But I had some actually newspapers, despite what publishers would tell you at the time, newspapers were very profitable then. They were undergoing some techie kind of changes that saved them money So I really did hit some glory days of newspapers from about 1980 to, you know, about 2000 or so, 1995. And so I worked in Florida where I met my wife. We moved to New Orleans where we learned to cook a little Creole and Cajun, you know, cuisine, and had a couple of children there. We lived in New Orleans for 10 years. And then we came out here. We came out here in 1990. I started, I was basically at that point had been doing a lot of editing work and missed writing. And the Times was at the time doing something called Laugh Lines, which is a daily humor column. So I started supplying those, and that developed into a weekly column, and I started doing some sports writing and some travel writing. And so I sort of segued. I still do some editing work, but I, you know, I'm primarily known for my writing and my, you know, I think if listeners will remember Irma Bombeck, fantastic writer about suburban life and the mundane day-to-day things that she found humor in. I would be thrilled if somebody made that comparison besides me. I thought that Irma Bombeck was just brilliant, and she was an influence also. But that's kind of what I do now. Now on every Saturday, I write about life in the suburbs of Los Angeles. They're not big stories, you know, it's usually not about getting a wisdom tooth out. It's about, you know, it's about getting up at 3 a.m. with the dog that is now
that dog.
Older than I am. So the 300-pound beagle. And we have sort of, it's a little sitcom, you know, it's a little sitcom-y. We have the 300-pound beagle now. You know, I'm fond of exaggeration. He's really only 250 pounds.
There you go.
But the beagle is basically runs the house. My wife Posh.
Well, somebody's got to be in charge, Chris.
Somebody's got to be in charge, right? Yeah, and I back away from that. That's too much responsibility. and then we have four children. We'll get into that, the numbers of that.
Yes.
It's kind of an interesting situation.
Yes.
Four children who supply just endless. You know, sometimes it's just a conversation. Sometimes it's just a snippet of somebody saying something that leads to, you know, a whole column. And conversation is great. I love dialogue. I think that gives it a little bit of a sitcom connection. It's really, I've been doing this for 20 years now. And I think what I've learned to do is not look for the cheap joke. I look for the more expensive joke, and sometimes that takes a little. Sometimes that takes a little time and a little development,
mm-hmm.
and
mm-hmm.
you know, the setup is more. I mean, any humorist will tell you the setup is more important than the punchline. Is how you sort of come to the, how do you come to the joke and the payoff. So I've been a little more patient about that, and I hope that the writing has evolved and become actually a little bit more real than it used to be. I was starting out, and I wasn't sure I could make people laugh, and I wasn't sure I could keep an audience, and I wasn't sure, you know, if this was, I liked doing it, but mm-hmm. like any writer, you hope there's an audience for it. And I think I gradually found out, and thanks to email, you kind of find out what people are fond of and what they're not. So
absolutely.
That was a learning experience.
I don't even think that you actually realize just how special you are to the readers. You mentioned Irma, and a lot of us read Irma. You know, we could relate to Irma, woman to woman, mom to mom kind
right.
of thing. But your writing is relatable to all of us. And if I took the time to tell you how many people have said, would you please tell, okay, Lisa, Lisa really loves you. So I'm just telling you that Lisa said, please tell him. So there you go, Lisa. I shout out to you. And did you know that there's a, I'm sure you do, because people Google. I mean, what would we live with, what would we do without Google? Did
right,
you know
right.
that there's a Scottish pro soccer player that's name is Chris Erskine?
Yes.
Of course you did.
Yes.
He's
yes.
not you.
There is a Chris Erskine that plays soccer. It's obviously a success.
Yes, Scotland.
As opposed to
that's
this one.
Funny.
But it's very funny. It's a name. I actually like the name. I mean, it's not a common enough name. It's often mispronounced as Erskine or Erskine or whatever it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it's different enough. There's an Erskine College. I think it's in South Carolina. There's the soccer player, who, you know, Erskine. There was Lieutenant Erskine on the FBI show.
I didn't remember that.
Ephraim Zimbalist Jr. Yeah, that was really the first time that that name really got out there. There was the writer Erskine Caldwell. There's you know, it's out there just a little bit. Anyway, it still gets mispronounced. So.
Well, you know what? We'll just go with Chris. Listen, you don't have Whiteheka as the last name. I can't even tell you how that's switched.
I shouldn't complain about that, right?
Yeah, most people, it's like, how do you say that? You know, if we have time, I want to talk about the newspaper business, but because a lot of things have happened in the Los Angeles Times just in the last week. But what I didn't realize, when you write your column for the Los Angeles Times, it also appears in the San Diego paper as well. The Tribune.
I believe so. Occasionally, yeah. I don't know if they run it weekly or not. I should know something like that.
Yeah,
a lot of papers
run
it occasionally. Yeah, sometimes it's very LA centric. Sometimes it's very much about an event like this coming. The one this Saturday will talks about the book fest.
At
USC. So that doesn't really translate to Buffalo, you know, and Buffalo does run it and places around the country, Orlando and Fort Lauderdale and so forth, but they don't want to hear about a book festival. So there's times where they go dark and don't run it. Chicago Tribune runs it regularly, which is a kick for me because
I grew up
there. And so there was a lot of people. I have a lot of people I grew up with who never thought I'd actually graduate high school, let alone hold a steady job. So this is this is a sweet. It's not a great revenge, honestly, you know. But it's a little bit. It's a little bit of like, God, that guy's not in prison. I mean, so there's that, you know. I have a lot of friends back in Chicago, and it does. I think it does because of my sort of Midwestern sensibility. Now blended with a West Coast sensibility, I'm a bit of a hybrid, but I think that it does translate to other parts of the country and as regional as we try to be and as prideful as we try to be about where we live, you know, we're more similar than we'd ever admit, and I think that's true of different ethnic groups and everything else. We have way more in common than we have differences, and so we should celebrate the differences and celebrate, actually also realize that we have the same hopes and fears and everything else. So
you've just quoted something that I say constantly when it comes to travel and when it comes to humanity. And that's why, while this is an internet radio show now, people say, what channel do I put it on? Well, you don't. You do have to go to the internet. But, you know, and sometimes what I'm talking about is local to what's going on here in Westchester where I live, because I did used to be in the studio for just about the first 3 years. And so my guests all had to live close enough to join me. But now that I'm on Blog Talk, which I'm really enjoying, we don't know if you're in your jammies or not. I can tell you I'm not in mine, but who can see you?
Right.
So it's okay.
Right.
But we do, I think that your column, while maybe they aren't going to come to the LA Times, Festival of Books, you write from a way that everyone can relate, and that's what I think is the beauty. You've been writing about parenting for a long time, haven't you?
I have, and you know, it was so funny because I was doing the occasional humor columns, and then the lovely Michelle Williams, an editor, came to me one day and said, this is a life-changing moment. She said, can you do this every week? And I said, I honestly don't know. I don't know that I can do it every week in a way that with enough freshness and enough different a range of topics and situations that sustain. So, but I sure would like to try, you know, if you're up for it. And so here we are 20 years later, and some people would say, no, you failed miserably. I tuned out after the second week. And then other people will go like, no, I get it. And it is. And again, it's not, God, it's everything from stuff that happens to the mood I'm in, to something my friend said, to You know, it's a little kind of a mood piece. In some ways, it's kind of a mood piece, you know. It sort of reflects where we're at. And, it's, you know, sometimes it's happy-go-lucky and upbeat. And then I think sometimes it's a little bit reflective and thoughtful. Sometimes it's thoughtful. I'd like to think it's always thoughtful, but it's, you know,
yes.
But it changes tone a little bit just based on sort of what I'm going through. And I think that keeps it, you know, again, real. I think as a writer, you want to be real. You want to be relatable. You want to sort of establish that connection. And I think the more real you are, the more you're willing to share, the better that connection is. And as long
I think
as you're
people recognize
and trying
to, that no. You're genuine, you know, your humor is subtle and funny. And, you know, I remember when the girls went off to college, you know, I mean, you
all
know,
right.
It's
right. Yeah.
You know, it's funny because, you do really, I think fatherhood's probably your most favorite gig you've got, right?
Right. Yeah. It was, you know, it was the best thing I ever did. I never aspired to it. It was, you know, it was, I wanted to get married. I found a wonderful woman, but I never thought, oh yeah, I want to have a family. It was like, it was never really part of my American dream. I mean, there was no reason for that, but some people, you know, some people are sort of born to it and some people sort of look for it their whole lives. And maybe that was fortunate. I just, you know, yeah, sure. Let's have kids. And so, you know, not a whole lot of, you know, hand, you know, we didn't, you know, wring our hands over. It was just sort of, we were young and we got married and we had a family. And so, and then we had a family out here, you know, we had two kids in New Orleans, two kids in Los Angeles. And you know, when they get you outnumbered, it's bad enough when it's 2-on-2, when you have two parents and two kids, they have youth on their side and strength and energy and passion. And you know, you're already really kind of outnumbered 2-on-2. And when they have you 4-on-2, then you're screwed. It's fine. And, you know, and it's fine, but you got your back up against the wall and parenthood is a humbling thing. And I think there are certain things about it in LA that are, you know, even more challenging, you know, the cost of living and the just
yes.
influences, the fast pace, the freeways, the getting around. But parenting is a very humbling thing. And
it is.
And LA, I think, and I think any big city, it's a little bit trickier just because it's faster moving and you don't have the influence that you might in a slower paced place.
Unless you're like me, where I've lived here my entire life, so I'm accustomed to this pace. But
you don't know any different, right? Yeah.
I don't, but I did not. My children are in their 40s. I didn't raise children with the internet. You know, when a kid was mean to your kid and they they picked on you, that wasn't cyberbullying and the different kinds of things that parents have to deal with in today's society. But you did mention the 300-pound beagle, and I was wondering, who do you like writing better about, the kids or the dog?
You know, people have been asking me that lately because now we have two dogs, so I write a lot about them because they listen to me. The dogs do, the kids not so much, and the dogs. You know, as anybody will tell you who's been around, you know, kids and dogs, you know, dogs have a certain amount of appreciation that the kids have trouble voicing sometimes. And they're trainer and they're teachable. Kids, you know, it's very spotty in that regard. It takes a lot longer. So I love what dogs bring to a house. I mean, it is just another thing it's another responsibility in a life of obligation, but I do like what dogs add to a house. And not just dogs, but pets in general. There's a different vibe, right? Having dogs around, and I think our whole life, my whole life growing up, we had dogs, and we've had dogs
cool.
the entire time we've had children, and
mm-hmm.
and they have their own set of challenges. Now, of course, we have this pet wolf in addition to the 300-pound beagle. My older son brought home this, what he told us was a Siberian husky. We're pretty sure, we haven't done the DNA testing yet, we're pretty sure it's mostly wolf, just by the way it drools and eats my shoes.
And howls
but
at the moon.
She's, yeah, and howls at the moon and, you know, looks at me when I take a steak off the grill. So the wolf, you know,
it's
just a new member of the family. You know, the wolf
sure.
is a new member of the family, and she's lovely. She's beautiful to look at and difficult, challenging to walk because she thinks she's pulling a sled. You know, he was bred to pull a sled through the Yukon and not across the streets of L.A. And so I just
That's
hold on
funny.
For your life. But, I mean, it's another
– great.
It's another challenge, and I think where there's,
mm-hmm.
you know, I think in most writing, whether it's movies or novels, you have conflict and you have challenge and you have
no kidding,
you know, and that's where the humor comes from.
Besides so, the yeah. column that you write, you have
right.
a book that's being released tomorrow called Dadditude. I'm sure that's a word you made up because it's perfect. And
Dadditude.
I love the
No,
cover.
I'm not that clever, Marcia. I had heard that word, and I loved
man.
It. It was my idea for the title, and I think it kind of
cool.
fits because the whole idea was that we were going to do a book themed to fatherhood. And it's kind of what I write about anyway. But, I mean, this was when we pulled the 50 or so columns from the files, we wanted to sort of emphasize the paternal aspects of what I wrote about. So we did it with
mm-hmm.
an eye toward that. Now it was hard to avoid. I mean, it would have, any 50 random columns would have sort of had that theme, but we basically, you know, Colleen Dunn Bates, who is the publisher, said, let's do 50 columns. What do you have any ideas on titles? And, you know, I thought, you know, this is life, this is us. I mean, very, very similar to the NBC show. I mean, I had sort of those kinds of titles in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And then I thought Dadditude, which is a word I had heard, you know, at the time. This is almost a year ago now. And Dadditude, I like that because it's you know, being a father is always on my mind, and how you handle it is part
mm-hmm.
of the, you know, part of this, you know, part of the, I don't know, if you do it well, it's not just that you solve all your problems, it's just sort of how you roll with things.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Dadditude sort of reflected that willingness to kind of roll with things and you know, get through each day. And sometimes it's just a matter of getting through each day.
Well, I get that too. I don't write a book, but I recognize Marcia-tude. Maybe I ought to come up with my own word.
Marcia-tude, there you go.
Marcia-tude. I may just use that. And Dadditude is your latest book. I have to make a note, somebody. Do I have a team? No, I don't think so. That would be me. One man band, Marcia-tude. I like that.
Yeah.
You don't mind.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
I'm a little tired of the Marcia, Marcia, Marcia. You know, that's been a little overused.
Yeah, I'm
so,
sure.
So, you know,
I'm
Marcia-tude
right.
is pretty funny, actually.
Marcia-tude is nice, though, because it's, you have a strong point of view, and I think that the attitude is just kind
what
of
do you
point
mean?
Of view.
What do you mean? That's pretty funny.
I think it's point of view, and I think that's what the attitude sort of represents, is sort of a point of view, or you get through a day with dad jokes and humor and a little extra, you try to muster a little extra patience than you normally would have. And
right.
It doesn't mean that you're, you know, you have a spotless record in that regard, but you do the best you can, you know.
Well, don't we all? I mean, and this is not your first book. I didn't realize that this is your third book. So your first book was Surviving Suburbia, right?
Exactly.
What inspired you to write a book?
Surviving Suburbia was actually a pretty good title, too, and that was also a collection. That was the early, probably the first 5 years from the first 5 years of columns. back when the Times had a publishing division that they did their own books, their own gardening books and humor books and everything mm-hmm. else. And so this was that was a collection then. It went to the LA Times best-selling list, which I was very proud of. And this column is all, or this book is also a collection of columns, but it's from the last 15 years. So there's no overlap. These are all new columns from the past 15 years. And I think actually, and I was proud of Surviving Suburbia, but I actually think the writing has evolved, and I think that, like mm-hmm. I said, it's become more patient and a little more sophisticated in some ways. Hopefully, equally as funny, because it's still about the laughs and the smiles. And so I'm real proud of this. I think of the three books, this is by far the strongest, and I'm really crossing my fingers that it does well. And I'm excited. I'm very excited about it.
How can our listeners that are not going to be in the Los Angeles area, maybe to go hear the LA Times Book Festival, how would they be able to purchase your books? Is it online? Can they go to Amazon?
Well, we only printed one copy, Marcia. That's the thing. So we're just going to pass it around from person to person. Yeah.
Would you sign it and give it to me? Okay. All right. Otherwise,
then nobody
if we were in the studio,
it,
see,
no.
You would have
if
probably
we only
brought
have the
it.
One copy. We only have the one.
Dang, that's
going to
be.
No,
you're not going to be able to monetize.
No, it's going to be hard to monetize it that way. There actually are several copies. It's available on Amazon. You go to Amazon.com and look for Daditude, Daditude, mm-hmm. or just search for author under Erskine. So it's there. You could just Google Daditude or Erskine. And
cool.
Or probably just Google Datitude right now, and I think it will pop
up
on
Amazon.
And you can get it online through some of the major bookstores and Barnes and Noble and so forth, and Vroman's, the great local independent
mm-hmm.
stores here. But you can get it around the country and in bookstores.
Wonderful.
Should be on bookshelves around the country starting the 17th.
Oh.
Yeah. I get it confused with the book festival. Tomorrow, the 17th.
Right. Great.
Should be out there, and you can order it today, and it'll be in your mailbox in a couple of days.
Awesome.
But anyway, I'm proud of it. I think it's a great, mm-hmm. It's hard to buy for dads. I mean, as somebody who is on the receiving end of those things, how many neckties and toolboxes and golf clubs can you – I mean, dads are hard to buy for unless they're, unless they have a range of interests. And most dads, their
mm-hmm.
interests are the kids, or their work. And so,
mm-hmm.
If you were looking for a Father's Day gift for somebody, I think I would hope it would be something they would consider
mm-hmm.
because I think it really does. It's not worshipful of fatherhood, but I think it does salute. What dads do and honor what
mm-hmm.
dads do and appreciate what dads do. Not that I lecture about anything. It's just sort of day-to-day stuff. But I think dads would feel a little less alone with what they go through and some of their frustrations, and they would be able to sort of smile at it. So new dads, old dads, grandpas, I think this would be,
mm-hmm.
I would hope it would be something that they would enjoy because.
I would agree.
And I think moms too. I mean, a lot of my readership, I don't know what my readership is versus female male, but I get a lot of moms who read it. I get a lot of grandmas who empty nesters who sort of go, this is a little bit of a journal of my life.
I
hear a lot
that,
of people
Chris.
Say, yeah, people
mm-hmm.
say you have a camera in our house. And yes, mm-hmm. I do. I actually have a camera in everybody's houses. But no, it is how similar the things that we go through, somebody's adjusting the toaster every day and I can't get a decent piece of toast because every day they turn that little knob another way, and I'm not smart enough. I'm so groggy in the morning. I can't remember to turn it to two. So I could I just get a piece of toast? Could I just please?
You're not asking for much.
I found out the other day. Yeah, well, not much. I mean, the 7-layer dip that they made for Super Bowl, it had 5 layers.
Yes.
Okay. I'm not one to complain.
Who's counting?
But when you say we're having 7-layer dip, What happened to the other two layers? Did you just get bored? Did you miscount? I mean, our seven layer death has five layers. And I think a lot of people feel that, you know, the trash always needs to go out. And it's never anybody's turn. I mean, you know, come on. It's got to be somebody's turn. It's never anybody's turn. It's like, what happened? How can that trash get so full so fast? And it's just a busy house. It's a busy house, and it's, you know, there's always something that needs doing. And those are those little things that we deal with and we laugh over. And I think that this book is sort of shares those moments.
So I want to know, how does your family feel about what you write about? Are they good with it?
Well, I haven't told them about it
for the most part.
So, I haven't told them about it yet. No, which is I used to joke about that, and they, you know, it's funny because my oldest, who is now, believe it or not, 34 and older than I am, she was like 12, you know, she was 14 when it started, right? So, and I was doing occasional columns when she was 12, but she was 14 when it started, the 20 years. So she came to it a little bit late. I mean, she sort of knew normal life, and then she knew what it was like to have life where everybody hears about what happens to you. The other ones, like my younger daughter and my younger son, kind of grew up with it. I mean, they really didn't know any different. And it's not like – it really isn't a diary. I mean, people have to understand, I don't write everything that happens. I mean, I'm respectful for their privacy and their, you know, their sense of embarrassment. And if, you know, I'm willing to embarrass myself more than anybody else. So I leave a lot of stuff out. And if I'm not sure if it might make them uncomfortable, then I leave it out. I mean, if there's any sort of wobble, if there's any sense of that, you know.
I think what's funny about you is that, you know, you don't really call your kids out by name or your wife for that matter. Everybody's got a nickname, you know, and and who doesn't love a nickname? And speaking of nicknames, because I don't know Pasha's real name, for those of us that have been following you, Chris, I would be remiss to not take this opportunity to ask about Posh, because that was a very scary time you had
a little over a year ago, late January, early February of last year. She had been feeling bad and losing weight, and losing weight is always a danger sign, and I encourage anybody who can't figure out why they're dropping weight to go see their doctor right away. We didn't do that as quickly as we should have. She had had some iron deficiencies all her life, and when she was tired, we just thought that she was, you know, not eating enough red meat or enough iron, you know, enough kale or whatever it was. So, you know, make some adjustments. She's still losing weight, and then one day she was just going, I'm just so tired. And I, you know, we ended up in the emergency room. That's how bad it was. I mean, she couldn't barely sit up. And so, right away they diagnosed endometrial cancer, which is basically the lining of the uterus. I think I have that right. Stage 4, yes. Which means that it is spread. Whenever they say stage 4, that just means it is spread from the original tumor. She had it in her lungs, and she had it in her lymph nodes. And so they did immediate surgery, which is a little scary because she was not strong. I mean, she had lost weight, and she was, you know, but the oncologist was, you know, insisting we got to get the tumor out, and that's what they did. Then she started chemo. Fortunately, if there's a good side to this, it's that she reacted very well to the chemo. She didn't have the awful side effects that people have. She was very lucky. She had a great oncologist, and that, you know, her scans were good. The residual cancer in the lungs and in the lymph nodes disappeared or was just so minimal that they pretty much thought that was done. Then about a year into it, one of the scans wasn't good, and it looked like the original tumor. Yeah, the original tumor in her abdomen had come back. and they didn't understand. Yeah, they're still not sure why it roared back, because it all the other cancers, and basically this was endometrial cancer in the lungs. It wasn't lung cancer, as I understand it, that it's really whatever the source cancer is. And it reacted well to it. The lungs had reacted well. The lymph nodes had reacted well, but still there was this tumor that had come back. And so they started with they started with immunotherapy, and then they did some radiation. And so she is back to work. She went back to work last week.
Oh, good.
So
wonderful.
Obviously she's feeling stronger.
Good.
They've had in the past really great luck with this immunotherapy and the radiation. And so we're just, you know, saying our prayers and crossing our fingers.
Absolutely.
You know, and she's very strong. She has no self-pity. She's very courageous about it. There's never a whoa, you know, why me kind of moments.
Mm-hmm.
Although privately, there's no doubt she thinks that, but she doesn't burden us with her, you know, anger over this. And she, you know, has a right to be angry, you know, never smoked, you know, drank very little. Didn't, you know, lead a risky kind of life, you know, in that regard. I was careful about what she ate. And you know, there's no rhyme or reason to this. This is just the unfairness of cancer. And it's the worst, you know, my pastor says it's the worst word in the language. And I think he might be right.
It's a fearful,
wars are preventable. And although they seem chronic, there's hope that we can not have wars, but I don't know that we'll ever not have cancer, and that will be a man on the moon moment, you know, when they
whip that. I mean, they're making strides. Yeah.
Great strides. And you know what they say? Yes. That the AIDS epidemic was a big reason why the cancer fight advanced so quickly. Part of it was the fundraising.
Good.
Part of it is what they learned in trying to solve AIDS. And all the trials and everything else. So it was a huge research effort, and that aided cancer. And fingers crossed. I mean, we didn't know if they'd ever be able to solve AIDS. And
that's true.
They haven't completely. But boy, look at what the AIDS cocktail, the
advancement.
HIV cocktail
oh my gosh.
It's done, yeah.
Look what Magic Johnson could say.
Perfect example. And I think that cancer is getting more and more that way, where you have it and they can extend your life for decades even. And so that will be a big step. And then of course,
you bet.
I used to have a buddy who said he dreamed of the day when your doctor said, yeah, you have cancer. Let me just write you a script for that. You'd be able to go take a pill and it would go away. I mean, that's the ideal thing. And I honestly don't know how close we are to that or if we'll ever get to that, but that would be
great.
That would be the miracle of miracles, right?
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about family and, I want to spend the remainder of this show talking about something that is difficult, obviously very difficult for those people that don't know. I'm going to read something that I wrote that describes what we're going to talk about now. And we're not going to talk about this without seeing light at the end of this tunnel, just so you know. But on last month, on March the 17th, the title of your column was The Most Awful Kind of Grief, The Most Beautiful Memories, So Long, Son. The unthinkable happened. You lost your oldest son, Christopher. We're going to call him by his name, in a terrible car accident. And you wrote about your instant tragedy and beautiful memories in a way that all of us were so, so touched, Chris. And it must have been so difficult to write that. I don't even know how you were able to do that. Can we talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we this is a, you know, every parent's worst fear. We worry about them constantly. It doesn't matter how old they are. We still toss and turn at night when they're not home or don't know where they are, or don't know that they're safe. But you never think, you know, you always have faith that, that things will turn out all right. Well, our son was 32 and still living at home with us. He'd been out on his own and come back and everywhere, but doing well and working. And he had a, he delivered to nursing homes for a local pharmacist. So he's, you know, they would get their list of supplies and he would go off and deliver throughout throughout Southern California and the Inland Empire, particularly the Inland Empire was a lot of the. Anyway, he did not come home one night, the night of March 3rd, the morning of March 4th. I got up and there was my wife on the couch and she said, "Christopher, did not come home." And I, and you know, you don't go to that worst place. You go, well, he had an accident. He went out with buddies. But I knew that Chris wasn't the kind of guy who would just go out with buddies and not text his mother. I mean, even at 32, he wouldn't do that. And really, he was not a social butterfly. He worked, or he was kind of a homebody. He'd hang out with his little brother and toss the football or baseball, or they'd play video games and just hang out like brothers do. So the fact that he didn't text or didn't come home was very strange. I mean, right away. I called his boss to see if he had completed his deliveries, and which were always late night and everything else, and he had. So I started calling the highway patrol and then found out, ended up talking to the coroner. That's when we confirmed that he had been in an accident. And then there was a knock on the door. It was weird that I kind of got it over the phone, and then there was a knock on the door. I don't know if they knew that maybe the coroner's investigators were you know, already in the neighborhood. But anyway, they personally show, it's like the Marines during war. They show up on your doorstep.
Really?
You. Yeah.
Who was
and
it that
is,
showed
it
up?
All the, in the, it was the investigator, was it, San Bernardino coroner's office investigators.
Oh, okay. So it's
the
not
awfulness.
The sheriff. It's
no,
the
it wasn't
coroner.
The sheriff. You would think it would have been.
Interesting.
You would think,
yes.
Yeah, they actually come to your house and they tell you, which is, you know, it's got to be the worst job in the world. But they were very good about it. It was, this is all, you know, this is all in a 20 minute period where I sort of tracked down on the phone. You know, I worked for newspapers for 35 years, so I'm pretty good on the phone. And the highway patrol was very good about, and I didn't throw, you know, I didn't pull any media things. This is, I was just following the, talk to Sacramento, talk to San Bernardino, talk to the coroner's office, and my poor wife and son, younger son, are hearing this. You know, I'm in the bedroom and I don't want them to hear. I want to be able to tell them. And initially, we learned that his car had been in an accident and had been towed, and there were a couple of minor injuries. So we were kind of relieved. Because of that, but it really, it was more like the wording was the injuries were minor and they didn't tell us about the fatality. And so that was Christopher. And so it was a terrible freeway speed accident and he was killed instantly. And, and then the worst, you know, at the bottom just drops out of your life. You can't,
it
you
does
can breathe.
You can't
barely
breathe.
Breathe. The sobs are, it's excruciating.
It's indescribable. Yes.
Yeah. And any parent and, you know, and a lot of parents go through this, which it's not as exclusive a club as it should be. I mean, it's rare that you lose a child, but not rare enough. And so, a lot of people go through this and it touches your soul and it breaks your heart in ways that I don't think ever can be repaired. And I was about a week later, I'm not even a week later, about 4 days later, I'm writing a eulogy for him. His one sister and younger brother agreed to speak, which I thought was very
brave
of them. at the service. We did a memorial service a week later, which is hard enough to stand up in front of a packed church to at Christmas Eve, let alone unless you're just a performer, and we're not a bunch of performers. We're just regular people. And so, you know, they talked about their brother, and they sort of tag-teamed it. They went up together and talked about their brother and told wonderful stories that made us laugh and cry. Then I went up and I you know, talked for about 15 minutes about him, and Posh was with me at my side, and we got through it, and you know, we got through the day. It was the worst day. And so one of my buddies said, you should write that. I said, well, I kind of already did. You think I was just winging it? I wasn't winging it, you know. And so then it just becomes, you know, it's, you know, here I write a weekly humor column about the family, and life isn't all rainbows and unicorns. It's certainly, it's, you know, it's, everybody has grief. Everybody has tragedy. This is the worst kind of tragedy. And I just started as a tribute to Christopher writing it. And,
but even,
and it was
just
therapy.
Let me interrupt
for
a moment.
Sure.
To just say, and I excuse my interruption. I told you I do this. Even through the grief of that, you still brought some humor to that about baseball and about the Cubs and the Dodgers. You know, you allowed us to cry and smile at the same time.
Well, it was the smiles I was going to miss the most, and those are the smiles are what I miss the most. I mean, he had such a great outlook on life, and he was so wry. I love humor no matter what. I love dad jokes, which are dopey and pun related and everything. But I really like wit and sort of a wry outlook, which is very Irish and Jewish. and certain, it just seems like certain groups sort of gravitate towards.
We get it.
And so I had a bunch of Irish uncles who were very wry and kind of sarcastic and ironic. And I love that. Not cynicism so much as it is just sort of a kind of thing. And Christopher had that great sort of outlook. And so so I brought, you know, that was, I wanted to remind people that what a wonderful thing. And my whole life I was, you know, I'm from Chicago, so you got to be a Cubs fan almost. It's almost like a local ordinance. And
of course.
And so, you know, when he was born,
I'm sorry.
You know, he had his first thing I bought him was a Cubs, you know, onesie. What do they call them when the babies have a
onesie,
right, with a feety. I think it was a Cubs thing, and you know, a little Cubs hat when he was two and everything else. And, you know, and then, you know, sure enough, he ends up a Dodger fan because that was a little bit his personality. He was kind of a contrarian.
Sure.
And, you know, if I had been a Mets fan, he would have been a Yankees fan. I mean, he's just a little bit that way. And I admired that about him, that he was his own guy. He wasn't like, he wasn't a carbon copy of me. He wasn't going to just buy into that because it was the right thing to do, which I still think being a Cubs fan is. But you know, he liked it. He grew up at Dodger. I grew up at Wrigley Field. He grew up at Dodger Stadium, and this was his his home turf, and he connected to it. And so, and I admired that about him. So, you know, I talked about that, you know, I talked about that a little bit, and just the ways that he made us smile, and, you know, the crap that he would make, you know, he'd make this corned beef hash, you know, the stuff you get the Ormel, whatever it is, out of the can.
Yes.
You put it in the frying pan with, he'd put extra onions in there. He'd make it worse than it already was. Somehow he made corned beef hash worse out of the can. And he'd add garlic and onions and potatoes, and he'd, you know, and he'd had this big plate of stuff. And
delicacy.
And yeah, it was always a delicacy. He put more time in that than the original, you know, Hormel did. I mean, but he liked his stuff. He didn't always eat the best way, but he kept healthy, he kept active, and
good.
That's
fun.
Know, I loved his double his In and Out burger like all young
double
people
double?
Do and double double.
Wait a minute.
It's
what do you mean? Just young people. What do? You put, you don't tell me you eat it with lettuce, right? You don't put a bun on your
Oh, God forbid, no.
God forbid.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
So anyway, it's so that was, you know, it was the smiles, and that's You know, mm-hmm. it's always been my survival mechanism, and it has last month or so in columns where we just smile over some of his behavior and everything else. But that doesn't mean that we don't get these. I compared it to a boulder of grief that you feel like mm-hmm. you can't lift the boulder yourself.
It's just, or it's chasing
you.
Yeah,
you need other people. Yeah, you need a group mm-hmm. of people to help you move the boulder off of you. And that's, I think that's a pretty good metaphor because you just mm-hmm. feel crushed by what's happened.
We talked a little bit about this, and I was in touch, actually, with this person. But I don't know that you honestly recognize how loved you are by millions of people. You are too humble to say, well, duh. You know, but it's true. And
I think, Marcia, there might be dozens of people, but that's very nice. That's
right.
That's very nice. I mean, I do love my readers have been unbelievable through this and a source of great comfort and words and songs and poems and everything
oh
else.
Oh, my gosh.
So,
we've got to talk about this guy. So, because I was, I'm Googling around, checking you out and everything, and I came across this attorney. His name is Stephen Rubin, and he was so moved by your song, So Long, Son, that he immediately, what a talent, he immediately wrote a tribute to Christopher. And for those of you that are listening and are just curious about this, you can Google Stephen Rubin, or you can Google So Long, Son, and you can listen to this man sing a song. I mean, that blew me away. Phenomenal.
It's just the kind of music I like. It's kind of the music I like anyway. I mean, sort of Fogelberg, John Prine, and that mm-hmm. kind of stuff. And it was just beautiful. And here's the thing, Marcia. I mean, it's hard enough to deal with. Music always sort of heightens the emotions. I mean,
it
so
does.
If you're feeling sad and you listen to some Paul Simon, you might feel sadder, And
mm-hmm.
so this was uplifting and such a tribute to him
mm-hmm.
that to Christopher that I'm still blown away by it. It's really one of the nicest, most thoughtful things that anybody's ever done, And I appreciate Steve doing this. I mean, it's just
because you don't
just
know him, do you?
No,
you don't know him, right?
No, we've exchanged.
You know,
I don't think we've ever met. I mean, I meet a lot of people
mm-hmm.
through the hiking club, the happy hour hiking club, and at various events and stuff. But I don't think I've met Steve. And I apologize if I have. We have exchanged emails. I mean, I know the name.
Yes. Yes.
And so we've exchanged emails over the years and everything else, and so we're buddies that way, but we're not anything more than that. And so,
it's
the fact that he did this was just amazing to me.
You and I had spoke before we started doing this show, and I had expressed to you that I did not instantly lose a son. But I did instantly lose a husband of nearly 40 years. We were together at the Staples Center before day two of the Pac-10 tournament. It was still Pac-10 back in 2009. And you and I were talking about how sometimes it's that person that you least expect that does something like Steve. Or the
mm-hmm.
person that is wanting to console you because they feel so bad, and you find yourself now consoling them. You know, when I posted your Facebook, I shared your Facebook page because I saw it the day before it hit the Times, and my friends were writing to me talking about their sadness and reading about Christopher, and I actually forwarded that to you with their names, and I know that Leah got in touch with you because of the immediate loss of her son some 20 years ago that just was unexpected in a crosswalk. There are stories, and when you talk to as many people as you do, and you reach as many people as you do,
And I talk to a lot of people as well. We do have that in common. And when I talk about it, Chris, I don't know what happens, but my right hand just always immediately goes to my heart. And when you were mentioning music, for me, anytime Fleetwood Mac came on, especially
right.
Landslide, oh my God, I just could barely stand it. And then when I was watching Glee and they did their rendition and the Dixie Chicks did their rendition,
oh, yeah.
And, you know, I just finally just had to just accept and smile instead of cry through the song. And so I sing with it now as opposed to weeping, you know, so
right.
I want to make sure that if listeners follow you, Chris, that they understand the easiest way to do this, especially if they're not local and but they're listening in New York and they really do. So would you like to tell people how they can follow you through your newspaper writing?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, probably the best way if you're out of the market is to go to latimes.com / Erskine, Erskine. And that
right.
will take you directly to where the columns are.
Right. That is where you're all located, all of the columnists.
Yeah,
and they can click
right
on you.
Right.
I frequently
post them on Facebook. I mean, to survive, newspapers have had to put up a paywall. The New York
right.
Times was one of the first to do it, and we did it too. So now you sort of have to mm-hmm. subscribe online. You get a limited number of stories free, and then they hit you up for the subscription. And again, we have to survive. We can't give this. We can't
right.
give it away. I mean, it's and
right.
so.
No, you're absolutely
but
right.
I do for people who otherwise wouldn't go on there as a way to promote it. I do post stuff on Facebook on my Facebook
mm-hmm.
page. So you could search Chris Erskine on Facebook, and
right.
then you can send me a friend, you know, if you're not into this, it's really very easy to do. I can do it. So
mm-hmm.
it's easy.
I
and,
know.
You
send a friend
request. You can do that.
And then you wait. Wait, do you hear this?
Yeah.
And then you wait. Hello. Reminder. Anyway, that was just me reminding.
Yeah.
That was pretty obvious. But yes, you know, and the other thing, the other thing is that, so, you know, now you're really on the hot spot if you don't respond to that request. If people want to do the hiking club.
Didn't I send you the request?
No, you
did
not.
I think I did. You didn't get it?
Well,
okay, let me do it
no.
again.
No. Okay, thank you.
Because I did a couple days ago when you had asked about that.
Yeah,
and again,
this is
the frustration of anything with
yes.
with websites and platforms.
Yeah.
Sometimes they work.
How
and
about,
you think they work and they.
Yeah,
kind of
like when you're doing a live radio broadcast and then the host call
right.
drops, kind of like that.
Yeah,
if people want to join your hiking club, and I have to tell you, I'm going to be honest, I've had trouble figuring that out myself. So how do you get notifications of your hiking club? Where do you go
well,
for that?
Well, we do it on we want to do a special page for that, but in the meantime, if you want to join the hiking club, and just as a little background on that, we do a monthly
yeah.
hike. We've been on hiatus
okay.
since Chris's accident, but
sure,
we kind of a monthly hike around Southern California. And there's, you know, one of the glories of living here is the endless hiking trails
right.
through really pretty areas. And so we hike, and then we go to happy hours. So we hydrate, we hike, then we hydrate. Because it's healthy,
mm-hmm.
and we go have a cocktail, and then if we have two cocktails, we Uber home, or we, you know,
right.
whatever it is, we try to keep it safe. But anyway,
right.
so it's called the Happy Hour Hiking Club for its obvious happy hour connection. And if they
mm-hmm.
want to get on the mailing list for that, they basically just have to email me, and it's Chris,
okay.
CHRIS dot Erskine, ERSKINE,
okay.
at latimes.com. And LA Times
awesome.
Has no periods in it kind of thing. So, that,
right.
you know, and then I'll put them on the thing. And when we have a hike coming up, I usually give about a week's notice. And then we can't take everybody because we can't find a saloon that'll handle everybody.
Right.
So we usually cap it
right.
at about 60 or 70 people. And
mm-hmm.
and that usually accommodates most people, you know, because we move
yes.
different parts of the circulation area and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway,
well,
it's
that's
a lot
good.
Of
you
fun.
Know,
it's a great group. Yeah, it's a great group of people who just, you know, appreciate the simple things. And, you know, here we are in this gigantic city, and people,
right.
sometimes you still have trouble making connections and making friends. And this is, you know, you're dealing with newspaper readers generally, which is kind of a nice filter right there, because they're engaged and informed and everything else. So that's kind of a nice filter. And then people who like to hike is kind of like, and then these aren't, this isn't a serious hike. This is
no.
something that people who are reasonably fit can do. And then it's
right.
a sort of a celebration of LA and the different topography. And sometimes we're in the beach, sometimes
it's
we're
terrific.
In the mountains.
Yes.
Yeah. And so it's
and
a great,
and now
it's,
that
it's,
I know,
it's a great way. Yeah.
Now I know I need to get on your list, because I thought, how do I get on the list? So now I know. And it's true that, you know, you end up talking to people. And then I saw this lady walk in to when we went to the Sagebrush.
Sage Cafe.
Sage Cafe, the vegan place in Culver City.
Right.
And I could see this lady had walked in. She was by herself. It was obvious to me. And I know I'm a single person. You want to be sort of included. And we brought her over with Leah, and I sat with her. And then, lo and behold, we started learning about what we have in common.
That's wonderful. See, for you to sort of spot that and then reach out, that's the kind of group this is. They're the kind of people who would do that. They would go like, there's somebody who came in, she's unsure, she's her first time here, and she's a little uncomfortable. Hey, let's let's reel in the rookie, And I think that's a wonderful thing. And next time she'll do that for somebody else. And,
you bet.
And,
you absolutely.
And it's
truth.
It's a very simple thing. It's free. I mean, all you're really obligated to do is, come up with $20 for your couple of drinks, and they usually give us, a lot of times they'll give us a break on the grub.
Oh, they
and
gave
so,
us a break on the food. Sure.
Yeah. So mostly it's just a way to sort of meet people and get out and everything. And really, people wonder, well, I can't meet people. I haven't made friends. And especially as your kids get older and you don't have those normal social circles of little league and school and everything. And this is a way to sort of just, hey, you know what? I'm just going to reach out. And we've made, we have wonderful, wonderful friendships. And, when Christopher passed, a bunch of them, kicked in and hired a gardener to put a tree in the front yard for us. Just blows me away. Yeah. Beautiful liquid amber, and if you don't know liquid amber, it's kind of a maple tree, right? So it changes, one of the few trees that changes colors in Southern California.
Close
in the fall,
to New England as you're going to get.
Yes, right. They're beautiful. You think it was a maple tree if you didn't know better. And
yes,
it's just,
you would.
It's perfect because he loved the fall, and he loved the Sierra, and he loved nature, and so that was, and that came out of the Happy Hour Hiking Club, and it was such a wonderful, wonderful thing, and my buddy Bittner sort of spearheaded that, and just
way
it,
to
it just,
go,
I get teary thinking about it. Yeah,
I bet you
stuff.
Do, I bet you do, and let's not end this with the teary, so let's
right.
Let's not. So I guess you don't want to talk about my Dodgers. Let's see. So although they're doing just awful this year.
I have no answers to your Dodgers. No, I don't. Justin Turner, maybe.
Christopher, did he get to a World Series game last year at least? Did he get to one?
You know what?
Was
I don't
he
think
able?
He did. I mean, tickets were so ridiculous. He didn't like crowds. One of the things about Chris is he really didn't like crowds. He loved sports, and he would go to Dodger games. But a World Series, that's a big spectacle, and there's a lot of, it's 2 hours to get in, 2 hours to get home, and he didn't like that.
It's a big
deal. He was just as happy to be with his little brother and me, watching it on TV, and like a lot of us, it's like, tickets are so ridiculous. Find a few friends and watch it on TV.
To a season ticket holder here. Ask me.
Yeah, no.
Ask me how long
yeah.
I've been a season ticket holder.
How long
I'll
have you been?
I'll tell you before you ask. 1986. Okay, so
wow.
You Cubby fans, I get it. Congratulations.
Right.
I was happy for you. But You know, what was that? Well, I can tell you. Okay, this is so random. We're definitely running over, but I can't help myself. Do you know how many stitches there are on a baseball? Think of a hard ball and think of the stitches.
Yeah, it's 88.
Nope.
No. You're close. I know that. 108. 108 stitches.
And why is that significant to you?
Because it was 108 years between World Series wins for the Chicago Cubs.
That's right.
So, right.
There you go. So there you go. Yeah. Random information.
It was meant to happen. That was pretty great. And I'm hoping, I would love to see the Dodgers get it together this year. It would mean a lot to my youngest son. It would mean a lot to the memory of Chris. I'm a Cubs fan. I bleed Cubby blue, but that's not too far off of Dodger blue. And I do like Dodger fans. And I love that experience. It's a wonderful thing.
And I think, you know what,
Marcia, it's a streaky game. You get hot, you get cold. As long as your pitching holds up, you'll be okay. Kershaw looked good, last night. And I think it's a long way from over.
It's a long season.
They could go 40. They could win 40 straight. I mean, they are capable of that. It's a very good team. Yeah.
Well, listen, my friend, honestly, because of who you are and what you represent, what a terrific storyteller you are. I think you should join Toastmasters, but that's just a side note, like you have extra time. I don't know if you've ever thought about that, but you would win any contest you were ever in, except for your aunt.
No. I'm better on the page. I'm better in print. I mean, I like to, obviously, I don't mind talking, but I get self-conscious in groups. I actually do a lot of talking, but I'm better on the page. And there's no question about it, but I'm flattered that you think that. There's different ways to tell a story, and I like all of them. You know, sometimes it's by song. Sometimes it's in a movie. Sometimes it's in a TV show. And so I just love great stories. And I like the connection and how it brings us together. And it's culture at its best. Culture is culture? Is it opera? Is it the symphony? What is it? Culture is storytelling is what it is. It's sitting around a campfire. It goes back to the campfire. You know, when we're sitting around the campfires, and I think
I want to be your next door neighbor. I don't think I'm going to move, but is there a house next door I could just borrow, or maybe I could just come, a sleepover and just spend the night. Oh my God.
Well,
you're going to come
with a happy hour hiking club. You're going to come on the happy hour hiking club. And so that's neighborly. And then you can ditch me whenever you need to, which is, that's handy too. So,
well, I just want to truly thank you for your bravery, for Chris being Chris, for spending this time with me. I have to tell you, I walked around going, you aren't going to believe who's going to be on my show. And it's like, is it Chris Erskine? Chris Erskine? Do you know? Not the football soccer player.
Not the soccer player. That's what they must have thought.
Are you kidding? Anyway, I just want to thank you so much. Maybe we'll do this again in 6 months and we can catch up on where you are from there. I look forward to your hikes. I look forward to your friendship. And I hope that everyone listening today has had a little piece of the story of Chris Erskine. It's just been a delight, Chris. Thank you so, so much.
Thank you, Marcia. I'm flattered. Thank you very much. This has been fun.
Okay, and we're going to end this episode now with no music. I'm sorry, but I wish you all a very beautiful day. Bye-bye for now.